But we're going to say that's incumbent on them. That's not up to us as the companies, and it's not up to the customer themselves to sell themselves to the government. Really, if the government wants to investigate things, they should do it the old-fashioned way.
I just got to channel all the moms in the audience for a sec. So you're in Russia. Now you're able to stay for 3 years, right? Right? So are you getting enough to eat? Is the food good? You look good.
Thanks. Yeah. No, my life has changed a lot. I work a lot more and a lot harder now than I did before. My previous job was actually, pretty easy. You collect a high paycheck for relatively little work. But nowadays, even though I'm working more, I'm much more fulfilled. And that's something that is satisfying. It means at the end of the day, as long as I am able to keep the relationships that I have with the people I love and work on the things that matter to me, I have a fulfilled life.
Well, I know you probably have an ungodly hourly rate, and these guys are in between scenes of their film. You all took time off.
And we're going to end it there because we've already heard that little segment of the piece. That was the voice of David Carr. He spoke on with Glenn Greenwald and Laura Poitras about the film Citizen Four, among other topics. And that was a segment from Flashpoints. We are going to go now to the KBOO Food Show. Thank you for bearing with all the little glitches this morning. I'm so sorry. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Hopworks Urban Brewery, committed to creating world-class food and organic beer as sustainably as possible at their carbon-neutral eco brew pubs. Hopworks is located at Southeast 29th and Powell Boulevard, and Hopworks Bike Bar is at North Williams and Shaver, available on draft and in bottles throughout Cascadia. Information at 503-232-HOPS or hopworksbeer.com. Also by The Garden Spout, specializing in indoor gardening equipment, including horticultural lighting, environmental control, hydroponic and organic ingredients, and pest control. The Garden Spout is located at 4532 Southeast 63rd, just south of Foster in Portland. Information at 503-788-GROW.
Some drink for the dry in my throat. Need for the world to recognize it. Everybody's in the same holy boat. Don't you know it ain't right for people to go hungry with all the food being thrown away? Just because it ain't the right size or perfect, 'cause you can't turn a fast dollar that way. You know it ain't right to make people grow coffee when their families could be growing food. Working those lands for corporations don't do hungry people no good, 'cause people need food in their belly. Need some drink for the dry in their throat.
Welcome to the KBOO Food Show. I'm your host, Chris Siegel.
And I'm Rachel Bennett.
Today on the show, we'll hear some tips from OSU Extension on how to grow the best tomatoes in our climate.
If you've been out to 72nd and Foster, you might have noticed a colorful new building. The Portland Mercado, a project of Hacienda CDC, is set to open its doors to the public in April. We'll talk with the manager of the Portland Mercado, Manuel Fauché, about the grand opening and what to expect from the space.
We'll also be talking with Kayla Rowling at the end of the program about CSAs around Portland, as well as an event that is coming up this Saturday called the CSA Share Fair. If you're interested in local food and farmers, you won't want to miss this event.
And we'll start with a segment on Distillery Row. Portland is well known as a hub for craft brewing, but what might not be as well known is the flourishing movement of craft distilleries in town. We took a trip down Distillery Row along the East Side Industrial District to see for ourselves what's happening behind the scenes of local spirit production. Oregon has an interesting history involving alcohol. The state outlawed outlawed liquor before national prohibition. The Oregon Liquor Control Commission, or OLCC, has had a firm grasp on the distribution and sales of alcohol. Despite that history, Oregon, and Portland in particular, has been home to a huge craft alcohol uprising. There are enough distilleries in Portland now to warrant calling a section of town Distillery Row. So we're going to go on a journey down Distillery Row. We started out at House Spirits Distillery, a smaller space bumbling with the processing of handmade spirits from the still to the hand bottling in the back. They have a number of products, with Aviation Gin being their most renowned, being hand bottled and shipped to 17 countries. Here's Andrew Tice, head distiller and director of production at House Spirits, telling us about Aviation Gin.
So, was the initial product here the Aviation Gin?
When they first started, they were doing a vodka with one of Chris John's partners, and then the Aviation was the second product, but that quickly became like the largest product and the thing that we became most known for. Mm-hmm. So that's definitely our flagship, and you know, has been probably for the last 7 or 8 years here. And that's the one thing that we probably devote the most attention to, and has the largest distribution for us, especially since it was one of the first and the craft gins that have appeared on the market in the last 10 years. We were really at the forefront of creating what we call the new Western dry style. So it's that more balanced botanical, as opposed to that London dry style, which is, you know, more juniper forward, and is very, you know, really familiar. So that's kind of our baby that leads the way here.
And it has an adventurous blend of spices from around the world.
Yes. Yeah. So when I think of gin, it was one of the first like globalized products. So when they were making this, you know, a few hundred years ago in the Netherlands, you know, they were sourcing in spices from all over the world. And that's where everything was coming from. So continuing that tradition is kind of what we're doing now. So the juniper that we use, we source from Eastern Europe, so Macedonia, Yugoslavia, they grow some great juniper. The orange peel, for instance, comes from parts of the United States, Turkey, Morocco, and Spain. The lavender is from France. Cardamom grows, I think, almost exclusively in Guatemala. Sarsaparilla is from India, as the name implies. And, you know, some of the other spices are grown like Thailand and parts around the world. So it really is like a global product there. But we've kind of picked the sources for it and the flavors that we want to kind of match the flavor profile that we want for Aviation. So we're kind of getting the best of the best. And we're ordering it actually through a local company, Oregon Spice, who sources, you know, just great spices from around the world. So we've been really happy to work with them. They're so local. It's a nice relationship to have. So we refer to it as like a botanical democracy, too, as opposed to maybe the tyranny of juniper, of gins in the past. A whole bunch of different flavors. And as you sip it, I think you kind of get that. One sip is kind of spicy. The next is a little bit sweeter. You get a floral thing going on, and then some citrus in another sip. So kind of like the way it jumps around on you, because all the flavors are... They're very similar levels, and they kind of poke through at different times. That's one of the nicest things about Aviation as a flavor profile. I think it's pretty unique. But it's kind of I like trying it neat, because it shows what the gin can do and just how different it is from other mm-hmm. gins. So you know, we're a small producer, so we have to do something, offer a different spin on things. So with our whole range of products, and especially Aviation, it's something that's different than the gin that you know and grew up with. So it's always fun converting people over. And they're like, I hate gin. I had it in college once. You know, they had too much of one night, and they'll never drink it again. So it's always fun to bring people in, and they're like, I hate gin. And they're like, oh, this is really good. You could sip it neat or on the rocks.
Yeah.
So it's very approachable, but it's got a really interesting set of flavors that kind of changes sip to sip, and it plays really well in classic cocktails like the Aviation cocktail, for which it's named.
So what's the Aviation cocktail?
So the Aviation cocktail is one of those classic pre-prohibition, you know, 20s, 30s kind of cocktails. It always has gin in it, lemon juice, some simple syrup, maraschino liqueur, which is like a liqueur made from cherries. Mm-hmm. So it's a clear liqueur, but it has a kind of cherry nuttiness to it. And sometimes people include creme de violette, which is a purple liqueur, and it gives the drink a light blue color, which is kind of where the Aviation came from. Usually I omit it because it's a very flowery liqueur. Mm-hmm. And so I like the cocktail without the creme de violette, but If you're a purist, you would say you want the creme de violette.
We talked a bit about the history of distilling spirits and the range of products they're creating and experimenting with at House Spirits Distillery.
Distilling is such an old process.
It's really one of the, it used to be, it was considered alchemy there for a long time because people really didn't understand it. So it's a very old process. It's not nearly as old as, say, brewing or winemaking, which goes back thousands and thousands of years. So you needed a bit more technology to achieve distillation because, you're heating up, if you would just heat wine, all the alcohol would leave. So it took them a while to figure out, alchemists and scientists, 400 or 500 years ago. It's kind of when modern distillation really took place. And people were, they figured that they could separate, more of the alcohol out. And so you see things like brandy wine, so like fire wine. You would say about 400 or 500 years ago is when it really started and people started understanding things about making perfumes and extracting flavors and aromas from, just all sorts of things. So, and that's kind of where gin gets its start. Is gin used to be made from a grain base, which is highly flavored. We use neutral spirit in making it because we just want a really blank canvas with which to make the delicious flavors that we're picking out from the botanicals. But, back when gin was, invented, for lack of a better word, in the Netherlands a few hundred years ago, they were just trying to cover up, a really foul-tasting alcohol. So now it's kind of come full circle where it's really a great expression of flavors that you're trying to make as opposed to covering up things. So, the alcohol, you can guess 400 years ago, wasn't of the highest quality or, who knows what was in it. So that was often used to cover up a lot of those flavors, whereas now, these are the flavors that we want. And it's really come a long way. But, in a lot of ways, even with our modern equipment, we have very simple stills. Essentially, they're just heating things up. And as soon as that vapor hits a cold area there on our condenser, it's just condensing right back into there. So there's not a whole lot of separation that's going on there. Which brings over a lot of flavor, which is what we like. But it's not one of the really fancy stills that can separate things out and make... You couldn't make vodka on our stills, for instance. It just can't separate it out to that high level of purity. So when we're making our vodka, we're doing a lot of filtration on an existing source to make the vodka that we make. But for the gin and the aquavit, that neutral spirit is invaluable because it just, like I said, gives us that blank canvas to paint on and make the spirits that we do. When we start with when we make the whiskey, of course, it starts with beer. So we're taking that from the very basis, that fermentation to distill it down to something that we're making with our whiskey. But different styles of products, but each delicious in its own way and a slightly different process.
We heard a bit from Kelly Sanders, assistant marketing manager, about the influence Prohibition had on recipes of spirits.
Before Prohibition, there were a ton of different people making gin in the United States, but Prohibition killed that that creativity that was happening. And there are all these really old pre-Prohibition cocktail books that have recipes using gins that nobody's ever tried because they died with Prohibition. And so Aviation is kind of a look at what that, like, if we could go back and taste these gins that were made in America before then, that we've lost, what would that taste like? Mm-hmm. Because what was left after Prohibition are the London Dry styles that that Andrew is talking about.
Yeah, it's kind of like brewing where there's, after Prohibition, there was one beer, there was Budweiser and styles like that. And now the craft beer scene is flourishing. We're kind of seeing all the great old styles as well as a lot of new styles. So innovation. So this is the innovation that should have happened 80 years ago, but now we're doing it. It's really fun to do, and an exciting place to be. So
lots of experimenting.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the name of the game. You really kind of have to push it. So we're experimenting with aging the aviation and in barrels, and so trying to offer a different spin on something delicious and new that we've not had before. So it's fun to get to play with a whole box of crayons that really no one has gotten to in the past. One of the most fun parts of this.
Next, we headed to Eastside Distillery, which is in the midst of expanding into a large facility with big plans on the horizon. The distillery began after the founder, Lenny, went to Belize and fell in love with rum. We talked to master distiller Mel Heim about the rum.
Rum is one of the more abused spirits out on the market, but it can be some of the most complex. It has a really cool history. It's actually the U.S.'s first national spirit. That was the first spirit we started making. So rum technically just has to be made from sugarcane or any derivative of sugarcane, so molasses, cane sugar juice, something like that. So we started with 100% blackstrap molasses and just made small batches of silver rum, unaged. It's kind of fruity. It's nice. It's a Puerto Rican style. And we took that and said, well, we nailed it. You know, we're pretty pleased. So that's the base of our flavored rums as well. So hopefully in the future, now that we are the proud owners of 130 barrels, opposed to four, we can start putting some away for later. Get some aged rum.
So it came pretty fast. The rum was there in some of the first experiments and jumped in, into the spirits game at that point.
Yeah. Yeah. We just started with the, this is the radio. You cannot see, but there's a small little still we have in the window there, as a decoration, but that's a Cornelius McMoonshine. That's where we started. It's a little 8-gallon pot still. And we still use it for research and development, but it all started there. The great thing about rum is that it's kind of a blank canvas, so that's why we see a lot of flavored rums on the market. It doesn't have a really intense alcohol flavor. It really picks up other flavors easily, so obviously tiki drinks and stuff like that. So that was the inspiration, you know, and then we made some flavored rums. And from there, you know, you just build a little capital with your first few products, and you can start experimenting with the more complex spirits like whiskey.
And so they moved on to whiskey. We asked about the story behind one of their whiskeys, which has a picture of Ambrose Burnside on the label.
We were trying to make a whiskey, and, you know, one of the hardest parts of making a new spirit is the branding. Like, okay, we already know the spirit, the juice, as we call it here. The juice is good. How do we make it stand out compared to everything else? So Burnside, here in Portland, we have Burnside Street. It's the main thoroughfare. You can't name anything after the street because Burnside Brewing did that. Dang it. Trademarks. You got to get there first. But we wanted something that was recognizable, so that would tie it back to the city, so Burnside. And General Ambrose Burnside was a notorious drunk. Actually, he's one of the worst generals in history. And he often, it's more of the funny story that comes with it, he would refer to himself as General Sideburns. Like, he would say his name backwards. And he does have some pretty impressive chops on his face. So we just took all that information and kind of, like, brainstormed, and then you get the Burnside bourbon, you got the Portland part, and then our awesome slogan, which is put some sideburns on your face, which is just fun. We had to have a little fun in the branding. So that's how that came about.
From here, we moved on to the newest distillery on the row, Rolling River, and spoke with Tim, one of the family members who founded the business. Tim, tell us about the distillery here.
Well, we're a new distillery. We opened last May. So we have four products right now, vodka, gin, aquavit, and a coffee vodka.
Okay.
A lot more products to come.
Mm-hmm.
Family-run distillery of my father and mother.
One of the most striking aspects of the distilleries is the equipment. The shiny stills come in various sizes and shapes of gleaming metals. Tim built some of the stills himself.
I have a welding background and metalworking, so it was built them to work exactly how I want them to work. Instead of having someone else's design and having me try to make the product I want out of it with something that wasn't designed for the product that I want to make.
So how does yours differ from what you would purchase from somebody else?
A lot of times the stills you buy, or unless you have somebody custom build something, they're more of a, they'll do anything, but they're not specifically designed for one specific item. So you can make adjustments, but I'm using more traditional designs, or and interchangeable parts to make different products.
Mm-hmm. Among the array of stills was a particularly modern-looking one. What's this little... looks like a little elevator right here.
That's actually a continuous run still, computer-controlled. A higher and more efficient way of stripping down the material for further distillation.
Fancy.
So does that work with, like, I know there's the front end and there's the back end that you kind of want to remove. Does that, like...
It makes some primary cuts.
Uh-huh. So it, like, knows where to cut things off. How interesting.
And then that'll give me a higher proof material to run through the other stills.
Gotcha.
When you ferment, you're 5 to, if you're lucky, 10% alcohol, and you got to heat all that up. Where if you can start with a higher proof material, it's less energy. And it's designed to capture heat and reuse it.
At our next stop, New Deal Distillery, one of the things you might notice immediately is a large, unique, and artsy copper still.
Are these two separate stills here?
All the copper that you see is one still.
Oh, wow.
Technically, but it's like a multi-tool, how I like to explain it, where we can set it up to do distillations more similar to like a pot still. So for, you know, bigger flavors like in your whiskeys and like a rum is done on that and brandy. And then we'd use the two taller columns for the vodka then for further refinement.
They're so tall and skinny.
Yes, they are. They look like flutes almost.
Yeah, I almost wish
it would play music.
They look like an organ, like big organ pipes.
Totally, yeah. We get a lot of customers coming in saying, you know, it reminds them of various things like Willy Wonka and the Yellow Submarine and all sorts of stuff. You get people who are really into like steampunk things or like want to get pictures in front of it. So, yeah, it attracts a lot of people. I think the copper itself is also very attractive. It's beautiful. And the copper has a physical and almost chemical reaction that goes on with it. So, I mean, there is a purpose to the copper still. Mm-hmm.
So could you tell us a little bit about some of the products?
It might be good to start with the New Deal just because this was the flagship product that we started making back in 2004. This is Tom and his buddy Matt had gotten together and decided that they were going to make vodka because there was no vodka being made in Portland at the time. So they got the legal permission to do so, and they made their own stills, and they just kept practicing and practicing until they got something that was drinkable. And so they handed it out to friends and business owners here, and it took on, and people still, you know, you'll see the New Deal vodka on the shelves of a lot of bars. A lot of people who know Tom remember him like going on bike, like handing them out to people. I've had some customers tell me their memories of Tom doing that. But yeah, it's similar to what it was then. Of course, it's changed over 10 or 11 years now. And also the equipment that we use allows us to make a better product. It might change in the future as well. We have some ideas floating around to just make it better and use more local ingredients. So, and then, of course, we made liqueurs, too. Our ginger liqueur is really popular. It's, you know, this was winning a bunch of awards over the years, and we use a lot of fresh organic ginger that we source as locally as possible, too. A lot of times it comes from Hawaii, sometimes it's coming from South America, depending on the season. But it's all organic, and we hand smash it all. So that's a lot of fun. The distillery smells great when we're doing that. And then that sits in a vat of neutral spirit and extracts the flavor of the ginger for about a month. So it's a really thorough extraction. And it has a great big ginger flavor, but it is kind of calmed down a bit because we add a little bit of water and then the organic sugar cane and agave syrup. So it's nice and sweet and smooth, but still has a nice kick at the end of it. It's great for mixing in different cocktails, but I do like to just sip it on its own. Like, if you have ate a little too much food or something, you're getting almost the medicinal properties out of the ginger. And then, before I get too far in the other ones, a rum is worth a mention. The rum is pretty amazing. It's not available in the liquor store, so you'd have to come to the distillery to check it out. It's made from sugarcane juice crystals. So like a dehydrated sugarcane juice versus molasses. So most rums are made from molasses. Mm-hmm. And molasses is really a byproduct of the sugar refining process. So it's really cheap. It's abundant. We've been making rum, you know, in America since we were importing molasses really from the Caribbean. But the French were doing something in the Caribbean called an agricole style rum. They were freshly juicing the sugarcane and then fermenting that and then distilling. So it had a lighter flavor. I think it's much tastier, in my opinion, than your molasses rums, because you're not really getting that sulfur, almost, you know, sour flavor that most people associate with rum. So this is really light and sweet, almost butterscotchy. It's clear, so it's unaged, and it's just lovely on its own. It would be kind of similar to a cachaça, if you're familiar with that. It's a Brazilian style, also made from sugarcane juice, but it's a bit more refined because of, you know, the types of equipment we have here. And then Tom, our master distiller, his amazing talent there too. So we're really pulling out those nice, rich, buttery flavors. So this is makes a great daiquiri, in my opinion, and also just delicious on its own. Then we have our Hot Monkey, which is a chili pepper infused vodka. So we use a few different chili peppers. They're all infused separately, and then we blend them to taste. So it's really like an engineered spice. And I'd put it more into the culinary world versus like the big shot, I'm just trying to burn your mouth off world of a spirit. It has great flavor, but it is pretty hot. And it's nice, it can be really balanced in a Bloody Mary. Also, I like mixing it with all different tropical fruit flavors. It mixes well with pineapple and mango and, you know, lime. I've been cooking with it, too. It just, the flavor is just really amazing.
What kind of recipes have you been cooking with it?
Oh, boy. Well, I guess the Hot Monkey and the ginger are something I cook with pretty often. The Hot Monkey has been really nice to put into bone broths lately. Okay. I've been doing a lot of bone broths, getting a big, like, you know, pieces of like beef bones, and then slowly over like a few days boiling it down and adding Hot Monkey, because it does help to break down like collagens and stuff, but also adds that great flavor. Putting it in chili, vodka sauce, anything tomato based or acid based is really great. Yeah, it's kind of an easy one to pour into things.
What about the ginger liqueur? What kind of recipes is that in?
The ginger liqueur is fun. I kind of think of that one as the most versatile product that we make, because that has gone into stir fries. I've put it over fish and boiled fish with it. It's something that I'm mixing with like root vegetables and done like root veggie bakes and stuff like that. Gingerbread cookies, gingerbread cookie icing even. I made sure to sneak a bit of that into there. Those are really tasty. But yeah, that's nice in teas. I know I was making a peach tea martini last year with a little bit of ginger in it. It's great in chamomile tea too. So I kind of played with it through every type of tea, like white tea, green tea, black tea, oolongs and everything. It's a nice addition for a little bit of sweet, but also just a great ginger.
That was Dan Lin in the tasting room of New Deal Distillery. To finish our tour of Distillery Row, we visited Stone Barn Brandy Works and spoke with Erica about their business.
Let's see, we make liqueurs, brandies, whiskeys. Case in point is right now, I don't know if the listeners can hear me unscrewing a steel tank, but I am just about to filter our coffee liqueur. We use a lot of our spirits as bases for our liqueurs, and we also distill some local wine for the liqueurs as well. So this particular blend is a bit of our apple spirits, our pear spirits, our cherry, and our plum, all of which have made brandy, but which we use part of the run to make this coffee liqueur in addition to some Pinot Noir wine that we've distilled and barrel-aged. So trying to find compatible spirits with each product.
What exactly is brandy?
So brandy is a fruit-based spirit, just as whiskey is a grain-based spirit. So typically when you get a house brandy, it's made from grapes, just distilled wine, basically. But we are making brandy out of the fruits I mentioned before, like plum, pear, cherry, apple. So we're basically, for all intents and purposes, making a wine mash from those fruits instead of grapes, and then fermenting it and distilling it.
We sampled some of the liqueurs, and Erica shared some recipe ideas with us.
What would you use it for, besides obviously just drinking it by itself?
Yeah, so we've made a lot of whiskey sours with the apricot liqueur. It's a wonderful whiskey sour. It's good in champagne or sparkling white wine. There's a really nice vodka, apple juice, apricot liqueur drink that's quite tasty. I've tasted a pisco sour with it, which is delicious. Some of the liqueurs pair really well with gin. Our quince pairs very well with gin. The apricot is not as nice with the gin, but and it would be great in rum drinks.
There's a taste of Distillery Row for you, and here's a bit about spirits to keep in mind.
Yeah. And I love to keep in mind that spirits are like essences of plants, really. We're breaking down, you know, we're fermenting a plant down into, like, it turns into a soup. And then we're pulling out almost like the ghost of the plant itself. So it's so cool. I love thinking, like, vodka that way. We're capturing just this, like, pure part of the plant that it started from.
Right.
And my education history is in herbalism and medical herbalism and stuff. So I love keeping that in mind that I'm still working in the plant business.
Yeah. It was like a form of alchemy back in the day.
Yeah, for sure. And that's where a lot of the roots go back to. I mean, distillation was a technology, right, that came about that not everybody had access to. So it was kept secret because it was really special, almost godlike, you know, process for people to go through to remove this, like, this pure, you know, thing. And it's amazing. It doesn't break down. It doesn't, you know, go bad. So it was amazing. It was like God to people, like, you know, distilled spirits. Plus, it was used as a base for medicines, too, and it would preserve them. So, yeah, I mean, the history of distillation is super fascinating to me. And I had been studying, you know, the history of alchemy and then into, like, early chemistry before I started working here. And that's when it dawned on me, like, I need to work at a distillery, because there we go. That's perfect.
There you have it, a tour of Distillery Row. The sound was a little rough, I apologize, but if you are interested in checking it out yourself, you can go to distilleryrow.com. They have passports available for Distillery Row, and you can go to the food show website or the Facebook food show and see pictures of some of the stills. And up next, Chris, what do we have?
Great. So on April 11th, the Portland Mercado will be open to the public. It's taken many years of planning, but the Mercado will be the hub for Hispanic entrepreneurs and food. I recently talked with Manuel Fouché, the manager of the Portland Mercado, about the grand opening and the process of bringing the building and space into existence. So for a little bit of history about the Portland Mercado, where did the idea come from?
Well, the idea came a long time ago, about 9 years ago, with one of our previous executive directors, Pietro Ferrari. And this idea came up because Hacienda CDC usually does affordable housing projects and has other programs that help the Latino and non-Latino community. So there was the demand started because we had some tamaleras that were cooking tamales in their home and selling them at farmers markets. But then we realized that, you know, they needed training, they needed a little bit more guidance to do this. So we started developing a program where we would teach them, you know, how to do things a little bit more formally. So there was more and more people coming to us. And so then a program called Micromercantes was born. And in Micromercantes, that's exactly what we were doing. We were supporting these entrepreneurs to just getting the right track. So when the previous executive director saw this, he thought it was a good idea creating a space for people to develop and to grow. into a better structure business. So eventually...
9 years.
9 years. That was 9 years ago. This evolved more and more to where we then built a commercial kitchen in one of the affordable housing projects. So they were using now a commercial kitchen. They were getting their licenses certified, whatever. They were going to more farmers markets. And after, you know, these took a little bit more speed, then the idea of the Mercado was born. And right now it was just a concept, right? After that, we started getting more people together from the community. And we created what we call an asamblea, some kind of like committee of different business owners. So they helped us to put some thoughts into this project. So this has been a team effort from the directors to directors of the community economic development department, from the people, from the community. So all of these ideas got together. And so then we started talking to consultants, we started talking to architects, we started just putting the ideas into more concrete thoughts and paper. So we have the Mercado as a concept born. And, you know, finally, up to the last year, it's when we started building. We started acquiring land, getting grants, making it happen. And now we're about a month from the opening, April 11th, and we're just very thrilled, very happy that this is finally becoming real.
Could you tell us about some of the vendors that are going to be at the market?
Yes, we have 19 different businesses. So I kind of like separate them in three groups. The first group would be the prepare hot food, and those are all the food carts. We have 8 food carts. And they're from different regions of Latin America. We have El Salvador, Colombia, Argentina, Cuba, Oaxaca, Mexico. And I think we have like 3 different Mexican food carts, but they're all from different regions. So that's one group, right? The second group would be the retail tenants. And we have a grocery store that sells fresh produce, fresh fruits, some imported goods from Latin America, but also a lot of products, a lot of local products from local farms. We want to make sure we're also helping our community here in Portland. You know, our farmers are hardworking people. So we also have butcher. We have a butcher shop and a choriceria. Chorizo is a spicy sausage. So we have a tenant that just makes chorizos and they're really good. We have a beer and wine shop. We have a coffee shop with different with coffee grains from different parts of Latin America and specialty beverages from Latin America. We have a candy shop. And I think that's it in the tenant spaces. And we also have office spaces. We have like an insurance broker, a sign maker, and we have one of our offices too. So those are the permanent businesses, and we also have temporary day tables. So if you want to just get a product tested, we rent you a space for the day, and you can just check how your product does, or, you know. And so we're going to do that on a daily basis too.
So what do you think that the Portland Mercado is going to mean for the city of Portland?
Portland Mercado, our mission is to be that bridge between cultures. And we're talking about Latin America. So even within Latin America, we have a lot of subcultures. And we want to show the Portlanders and the country, want to show that there's a huge diversity in food, in music, in arts. So, yeah, it's just we want to spread the message and share the great, rich, diverse culture. And, of course, helping business entrepreneurs from our Latin community.
And you mentioned that the opening of the Mercado is coming up. What do you have planned for the opening?
Oh, geez. We have a lot of things going on. So for the grand opening on April 11th, we're planning to have about 5 different performers. We're going to have a mariachi band, salsa band. There's going to be some dancers performing tango. We are going to have a DJ as well that is going to be playing Latin American music. So that's from the performing part of the event. But we also are going to have other events like contests that are going to kind of like be promoted through our vendors. As an example, we're going to have a piñata contest, perhaps, or a food contest. We just want to keep people entertained, right? There's going to be a lot of food samples. There's going to be beverage. There's going to be some activities for kids, like face painting, stuff like that. This is a family event completely, yeah.
Manuel, thank you so much for talking with me.
No problem.
You're listening to the KBOO Food Show. That was Manuel Fouché, the manager of the Portland Mercado. Be sure to attend the grand opening of the Portland Mercado on April 11th. You can find more information about the Mercado on the food show page of the KBOO website. It's possible some of you have already started planting seeds for your garden. I know we've had this really nice spell of sunny weather. The 2015 growing season is upon us, and it's time to get to work. Sometimes, though, it helps to know what to do. We recently talked with OSU Extension, home of many programs such as Master Gardeners, about growing tomatoes in our climate, a task that can be difficult since we have such a mild winter and mild summers as well. Here is Pukraj Diol from OSU Extension with some advice.
Hi, I am Pukraj Diol. I work as horticulture faculty with Oregon State University Extension Service. I am based in the Hillsborough office in Washington County here, and work with local metro area master gardeners for educating people about sustainable gardening practices.
Tomatoes and other solanums need hot weather to grow and produce, but Portland has a pretty mild summer. What's the key to growing the best tasting, highest yielding tomatoes in the home garden?
Yes, the tomatoes and other crops of Solanaceae family, like peppers and eggplants, they're all heat-loving vegetables. The key to successfully growing these here locally, number one, is selection of right location where you can get a lot of sun. Choose a location which gets at least 8 hours of sun. So that will be the south side of your house. And if you don't have a right location where you can get plenty of sun, then there are some alternatives like container gardening. So you can fit a few containers in a very small spot on your property, which gets a lot of sun. And the other option that I really love is getting a community garden plot, because the community gardens are large open spaces, and you can get plenty of sun there, which is required for growing tomatoes and other heat-loving vegetables. And sometimes growing those closer to a wall or a concrete area helps them get the extra reflected heat from the building. And then number two is choosing the varieties that are suited for growing under local summers, because our growing season is very short. So choose the early maturing varieties and that are especially selected or for our local Western Oregon region. So look for Oregon State University Extension recommendations for varieties like Early Girl Tomato or a lot of the cherry tomato varieties. They do very good because those varieties mature early in about 65 days. And then number three is providing the right care, doing the right cultural practices right from the planting. The most important cultural practice is planting at the right time. For tomato seeds to grow, the soil temperature should be between 60 to 70 degrees. And then for seeds to grow into transplants, a nice size transplants, it takes about, can take about 5 to 8 weeks depending on the temperature. So if you want to save that time, starting seeds indoors, you'll have to use a heat mat, and then you'll have to use a light, artificial light, because early in the season we don't have that much light here, even in our south-facing windows. Or the best is you buy established about 10 to 15 inch transplants, and then transplant those in your garden when the soil temperature is above 60 degrees. If you don't have soil thermometer, then a good rule of thumb is don't plant before the nighttime air temperatures are consistently above 50 degrees, which will be around, you know, first or second week of June. So I would say pay attention to these three things, the choosing the right location and choosing the right variety suited for our local weather, and then planting at the right time when the soil is warm enough to plant.
You can find more information about OSU Extension on the Food Show page of the KBOO website. If you're not planning on growing all of your own food this season, then it's a good idea to think about signing up for a CSA. CSA, which stands for Community Supported Agriculture, is a way to directly connect with local farmers to get the best food and produce available. To make it easier for you to connect with a CSA farm, there's going to be an event this Saturday called the CSA Share Fair, featuring local farmers as well as a number of activities. To talk about CSAs and the Share Fair, we have on the phone Kayla Rowling, the project coordinator for the Portland Area CSA Coalition, or PACSAC. Kayla, welcome to the Food Show.
Thanks. Really glad to be here. Thanks for having me on to talk about the CSA Share Fair today.
So to get started, could you tell us a little bit about PACSAC and what it does?
Yes, the Portland Area CSA Coalition is a group of farmers and community members, and we educate and promote community-supported agriculture. So I go out to events in the community or talk to community groups about community-supported agriculture, or CSA, what it is, why it benefits households, and how it benefits farmers. And we also organize programs for area farmers. We tour each other's farms and talk about community-supported agriculture and farming. So we reach both groups of people, the eaters and the farmers.
So why should someone sign up for a CSA?
So a CSA is, one thing about me is that I have been a CSA member for 15 years, a member of two different farms. And I have really found that for individuals and for my family as well, it is a wonderful way to eat better food, eat a more diverse variety of vegetables, and it helps me really organize, as a busy mom, my week, because I organize my cooking around the vegetables that I have. So on an individual or family level, it's a great way to experience new foods, expand your cooking skills, and eat a broader variety of vegetables, because each week you get a whole different selection. Sometimes you get the same thing, but you get a broader selection than you might buy if you were just going to the store. It is a wonderful way to support local farmers, because when you become a member of a farm and connect directly with a farm, you are providing the resources that that farmer needs to do her job for the season. She knows who she's growing her food for, and she has the capital, the resources to grow food and do her job. And you're allowing her to do her job well, and sort of in the bigger picture, the relationship between the farm and the household means that we are taking better care of our soil and our water, because we're making sustainable agriculture something that people can make a living at. Agriculture is a very challenging area to make a living, and community-supported agriculture is one system that can help the community wrap around the farms and support our farmers and also receive really wonderful food.
So how specifically does that relationship play out, the relationship between farmer and consumer?
So, so for example, at the Share Fair, so the fun thing about this weekend CSA Share Fair is that you can go and meet 33 different producers, most of them farmers, some ranchers, and one community-supported fishery. And if you find the one that you like, you can go ahead and sign up right now, early in the season. So there are a few farms in our area that have a year-round season, but right now is a really good time to join a farm. Most of them have not started their season. And you purchase a share or a membership. Some farms think of it as a subscription in that farm. and you pay in either upfront or in several installments for your vegetables. And then when the season starts, each week you get those vegetables. You can either go to the farm if you want an on-farm experience and pick the vegetables up. But there are also over 150 pickup points in Portland where you can pick up your vegetables from different farms. So that's sort of the nuts and bolts. And then you also, because maybe some of the vegetables might be new, your farmer provides you with recipes each week and suggestions on how to cook and use your vegetables.
I do want to get to the CSA Share Fair in a moment, but I also want to know, not every farm is the same, so how do CSA farms differ?
That's a great question, because I think that's why sometimes it may be challenging in Portland, because we have a lot of really wonderful options here. So farms differ in the quantity of the food that they provide. So some farms provide what might be called a full share or a larger share that could feed a family of four, but it really depends on how much you eat. It can also feed one really vegetable-loving person. And then there are those same farms might provide a smaller amount of food, and even there are individual shares that farms are putting together if you like to eat out a lot or don't eat a lot of vegetables. You can have an individual share. There's also different ways to pay. So there are at least 9 farms that will be at this share fair that accept SNAP benefits as payment for your CSA share. There are farms that the different farmers, every farm is unique. Every farm is as unique as its farmer, I like to say. And farmers like to grow different things. So one way to find the farm that really fits you at the share fair as well is to talk to the different farmers about what they like to grow and talk about what you like to eat. And like you mentioned, there are very each farm is unique. And I guess I'd also like to say at the share fair, you can also find farms that focus on sustainable meat production as a CSA. So you can buy a share in a meat farm. There is a CSA that does, I was listening to your program earlier about starting your garden, and Winslow Food Forest does a vegetable start CSA. So they deliver vegetable starts to your house at the times during the season when it's right to plant in the spring and in the summer for your fall garden. So that's a new option. There's a community-supported fishery that will be there, and many vegetable CSAs. Some CSAs also offer fruit, so if you're looking for fruit, that's a question to ask them if they have fruit in their share. So, yes, there are many options. And then, as I mentioned before, there are about 150 or more pickup locations around the city. So from Rockwood to Hillsboro, to Forest Grove, to St. John's, there is a CSA pickup spot in your neighborhood.
Fabulous. What can we expect at the CSA Share Fair this Saturday?
So this Saturday, it's going to be so much fun. So first, expect a lot of fun. If you're doing a spring break staycation, I hope you'll come and let the CSA Share Fair kick off your spring break. Because we're going to start at 10 at the Red, which is at 831 Southeast Salmon. And you'll find 33 different farms or farms and ranches. And I like to say that we've got farmers, ranchers, and fisher folk who are going to be there for the day. You can meet everybody, figure out which farm is right for you. If it seems a little overwhelming, there are matchmakers who will be there who will help you sort of figure out what would work best for you and your household and help you find, give you some suggestions of people to go talk to. And, you know, and to break the ice, we're having a really fun scavenger hunt. So there are questions that you can go and ask the farmers and learn a few things about soil. Maybe make a little art and get entered to win some prizes from local farms as well that day. So an opportunity to meet a lot of different farmers and learn more about CSA is going to be a big part of Saturday, but also many other things are going on. If you have kids, we have drawing drawing yourself as a vegetable self-portraits, and then three farm summer camps are providing activities. Zenger Farm will be there with their chickens, so you can come meet their chickens, and Schoolyard Farms will have help you draw and create your own seed packets and then fill them with seeds, and Savvy Allen Center will be there with seed-related and farm-related games to play. So there are many activities for children throughout the day. And you should also look in your kitchen, look in your shelves, on your shelves, and figure out which of those cookbooks have been sitting there for a long time and not really used very often, because you can swap them for brand-new cookbooks. We're having a cookbook swap meet. So come along to learn about CSA, but bring your cookbooks too. And for every cookbook or cooking magazine you bring in, you'll get a ticket, and you can exchange that ticket for another cookbook there or magazine. Or you can make a new friend by sharing your tickets with other people at the show who maybe didn't have a cookbook to bring. And then there's more. There's so much going on. It's going to be so much fun. You know, a big part of CSA is cooking. You have a relationship with a farmer. You get wonderful, delicious, fresh vegetables, and then you have to do something with them. So CSA really builds your cooking skills, expands your cooking skills. So another significant part of our day will be cooking demonstrations. And we're going to start with Dan Brophy from the Oregon Culinary Institute. And he's going to talk about some of the maybe the more challenging vegetables. All of our cooking demonstrations are going to focus on things that are growing in Oregon right now. And if you're a home gardener now or a farmer, this is the lean time of year. So we're going to talk about what to do with seasonal eating at this time of year. So Dan Brophy's going to start with winter squash and sunchokes. And then we're going to have a kids cooking with kids demonstration after that with Joanna Super from Turn Up the Heat. She does cooking classes with children and adults, and she's going to talk about how to get your kids involved in cooking and eating their greens. And then Kumi Rao from Ruchikala will talk about ways to spice up your CSA box with flavors from India and Mexico. We're having a CSA, the noontime showdown. We have the CSA showdown with Kathy Wims and Brian Smith and June Robles of Nostrana and Oven Shaker, and we're going to give them three identical CSA boxes that they will then open and each cook something different, and then we'll see whose meal is the best. And I think with all of these, everyone should know all of these demos, is that we get to taste the things that are being cooked. So come prepared to enjoy samples of delicious food. And then we will close out the day with Stump the Chef from Catherine Doomling. So Catherine has written recipes for CSA Farms for many years now and really works hard to help people learn how to use their share. And she's going to play Stump the Cook with you. So if you have questions about mystery vegetables or things that might challenge you, like I have sorrel in my CSA share this week, and I don't know what to do with it. So sorrel is always my challenge. I'm going to take that to Catherine on Saturday and say, Catherine, please give me two things to do with sorrel when it appears in the spring. And then our last cooking demonstration is easy ways to add fresh herbs to your weeknight meals so that you can add a little bit more spice your cooking. So I could just go on.
Yeah.
There are so many things going on.
Exactly.
Saturday.
And we've got about 20 seconds. So you could one more time give us the details of the event, the date, time,
sure,
and place.
It's the CSA Share Fair. Spring starts here. It's this Saturday, March 21st from 10 to 2 at The Red, which is 831 Southeast Salmon in Portland. And it's free. It's all free. And it's going to be so much fun. So please join us.
Great. Kaler, thank you so much for joining us on The Food Show.
Thanks for having me.
That was Kaler Rowling, project manager for the Portland Area CSA Coalition. And that's it for this episode of the KBOO Food Show. If you miss any of the show or want to listen back, you can find the episode archived at kboo.fm. I want to thank our guests from the Portland Distilleries, as well as Manuel Fouché, Pukraj Diol, and Kaler Rowling for being on today's show. I also want to thank our fabulous engineer, Tammy. Stay with KBOO this afternoon, starting with Jazz Lives. And don't forget to tune in again the third Wednesday of February for the don't forget to tune in the third Wednesday of April for another episode of The Food Show. Until then, I'm Chris Siegel.
And I'm Rachel Bennett.
Thanks for listening.
Need some food in my belly. Need some drink for the dry in my throat. Need for the world to recognize it. Everybody's in the same holy boat. Don't you know it ain't right for people to go hungry with all the food being thrown away? Just because it ain't the right size or perfect, 'cause you can't turn a fast dollar that way. You know it ain't right to make people grow coffee when their families could be growing food. Working those lands for corporations don't do hungry people no good, 'cause people need food in their belly. Need some drink for the dry in their throat. Need for the world to recognize it. Everybody's in the same holy boat. People got to have food in their belly. Need some drink for the dry in their throat. Need for the world to recognize it. Everybody's in the same. The trees down just to grow a bunch of cheap hamburger meat. You know those trees, they hold the topsoil, and those burgers aren't fit to eat. And you know it ain't right